So it's great to see you on this snowy February evening, and we have a small group. So I'm going to kind of open it up a little more for people to jump in with questions. Usually I kind of talk, and then we have questions at the end. But just feel free to get my attention somehow. You know, go like this, or raise your hand, or jump in with any questions. I think, you know, with such a small group, we can do that. And I'd like to, you know, if you have questions, before we got going, Mike and I and Janice and I were having a bit of a dialogue about different things. So I know there's questions that are coming up about your practice, about retreats you might be thinking of going to, or ways you might think about be going in your practice, so feel free to bring those up and get some individual guidance tonight. So I'm going to keep it fairly general, talking about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I know we've talked about this before. I'm going to bring some new aspects to it, hopefully, and relate it to insight meditation. One thing I've discovered is that, you know, and people say this, but to really, I guess, discover it, know it, is that pretty much everything the Buddha said is in the Four Noble Truths. In some form or another, he'll give different practices and put in different words and different lists, of course. There's all the lists that are in the Buddhist teachings. But it all comes back to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So that, to me, it just keeps pointing me back to, you know, just, you know, returning to these root teachings, and it's there. We don't have to, you know, read piles and piles of sutras or suttas in order to grok or to grasp what he was saying. In fact, I've met teachers. I met a Zen teacher, and I think I've said this before in this group, who I asked him a specific question about a sutra, and he said, I don't read them. But you're a Zen teacher. I mean, you're a well-known. No, it just clogs up the mind with more concepts and thoughts. I just sit. I find just sitting is helps me discover more about what the Buddha was saying than reading. And I had a teacher once tell me I could only read as much as I meditated each day. So, because I was a big reader, right? And I was kind of like a bedside Dharma. I always had three or four Dharma books, with different stages of reading them. I don't know if people are smiling as I'm talking. So, you know, I look forward to just diving into the latest, you know, Jack Kornfield or, whatever, Lama Suryadas. I think I've read all his books, and some of them two or three times. So, you know, just, and I'm not saying don't read, but it really boils down to the practice. And, you know, read the Four Noble Truths, and I mean, they're really short, and just take that first one and practice it for 5 years, and see what happens. See how many layers you can peel away from those rather simple words. So the Four Noble Truths, it's the first thing that the Buddha taught. First words out of his mouth after enlightenment were the Four Noble Truths. So he's sitting under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, beautiful place to visit, by the way, if you get a chance to go to that part of India. Lots of stuff has obviously developed around this Bodhi tree, and apparently the Bodhi tree has the same lineage to the original one. They kept taking saplings off this, and apparently that tree has a lineage back to the original tree. And I have a leaf from that tree. It's a tangent, but I was sitting under the tree with some Tibetans, and my eyes closed, and they meditate with their eyes open. And a leaf came off the tree and landed in my lap. And I'd gotten to know, mostly through sign language, because I don't speak Tibetan, and she didn't speak much English, a lot more English than I did Tibetan. Got to know her, and somebody else went to go for the leaf. I guess it's a very special thing to have a leaf from this tree. And she sort of jumped over me to protect me from the other people so I could keep this Bodhi tree leaf. It's like a ficus tree, if you're familiar with that kind of tree. So he's sitting under this tree, becomes enlightened, and he sits there and he goes, okay, like, is anybody going to understand if I go teach this? Like, this is way out there, what I've just realized. And he continued to reflect on if others would be able to realize what he just comprehended. And he wasn't immediately sure whether he should teach or just remain silent and live his life. And he decided he was going to teach. And the first person, and sometimes this is left out of the sutra. If you're familiar with the story, you might say, well, I've never heard this before. But this is, from what I understand, what Ananda said actually happened. Ananda was the person who remembered all this stuff and then recited it once they could scrape on olive leaves the writings. They were just passed down verbally from before that. So this is how it goes, and it's in the Majjhaya Nikaya 26. So he meets this young yogi named Upaka. And this is, he says to Upaka, I am one who has transcended all, a knower of all, unsullied among all things, renouncing all, by craving, ceasing, freed. I have no teacher, and no one like me exists nowhere in the world with all its gods, because I have no person for my counterpart. And he continues on like this for a few minutes. And so kind of put yourself in Upaka's place. You're walking along and you meet a stranger and they come out with this. I mean, what would you think? I mean, you might think he's kind of on drugs or, you know, something mentally ill perhaps. And Upaka actually kind of reacted that way. According to the sutras, this was Upaka's reaction. He said, may it be so, friend, and he walked on. So this is left out, but he was kind of shaking his head as he walked away. You can just imagine the Buddha walking away from that first encounter thinking, well, that didn't go so well. You know, maybe I should change my tact and my approach and perhaps who I offer this to. I think it's neat because it kind of shows that he's not infallible. I mean, I think he made a mistake in his first encounter. And perhaps that's why some people leave it out. Many people talk about him going straight to the four ascetics or mendicants, his old friends, and giving the Four Noble Truths talk. But there's actually a stage in there where he kind of went, he had to find his footing on how to teach. He couldn't just go and say, you know, I'm the one. And so his teaching shifted quite a bit. And that's what came out was the Four Noble Truths. He remembered these mendicants or these people who practice the austerities. Austerities is renouncing everything, like right down to food. You really sort of deprive the body And the idea is spiritual awakenings occur when all attachments, even to food, are let go, and they live on like a couple grains of rice and that kind of thing. But he thought these folks, you know, were close. And the saying in those days was they had little dust in their eyes. So he thought, I'll go. And in other words, clouding their vision. They had little dust in their eyes. So he thought, oh, maybe I'll have better luck with these folks. I'll be better able to connect with them. So he sets off towards Deer Park and Sarnath. And gives the where he met his friends, and he offered his first truth, his first teaching, the Four Noble Truths, or Lama Suridas, who I just was on my most recent retreat about a month ago, calls them the facts of life. Kind of breaks it down instead of noble truths. He calls them the four facts of life, which actually, when you think about it, makes sense. So here's how he starts with the second time around after he says monks. He starts off, he uses the word monks when he's just talking to anybody, but these in fact were monks. These two extremes ought not to be indulged by one gone forth from the house life. Gone forth means you've left as a householder, and you've gone and you've taken the path as a homeless monk, a wandering monk. What are these two extremes? There is devotion to indulgence of pleasure in the objects of sense desire, which is inferior, low, vulgar, ignoble, and leads to no good. And there is devotion to self-affliction, which is painful, ignoble, and leads to no good. And then at this point, he introduces the middle way, for which, you know, what Buddhism's famous for. And he goes on to say, the middle way discovered avoids both these extremes. It gives vision and knowledge, and it leads to peace, to direct acquaintance, to discovery, to nirvana. And what is this middle way? It is simply the Eightfold Noble Path. That is to say, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. That is the middle way discovered by a perfect one, which gives vision, which gives knowledge, and which leads to peace, to direct acquaintance, to discovery, to nirvana. And then he went on to describe the Four Noble Truths, and how to work with them. Basically, that's the story goes. And as the story goes, they were the four friends of his were so moved by the Four Noble Truths that they were enlightened on the spot. As the story goes, so. So that's the where the Four Noble Truths come from. That's their roots, and the first teachings of the Buddha. And I think he also presented them in a different way. In those times, it was he was in India, which was Hindu, with a lot of deities and rituals, and the idea of the Brahman being the only portal to knowing and to enlightenment, and things were fairly tightly controlled by the Brahmins. It was also the sort of the notion of a lot of rules kind of dogmatically applied at the time. And the Buddha presented this as not something to be believed by him, and not something, and not rules to follow, but things to discover, to become acquainted with in your life, to see if it's true for you. And that's, I think, one of the things for me that sets the teachings of the Buddha apart from many other teachings that I've been exposed to. I've been exposed to a lot of them. I was a Christian missionary. I was a yoga teacher. Well, still am, I guess, a yoga teacher. And studied Hinduism for the Vedas and Avanta Vedanta for some time. So I was a Zen teacher for a while. So I've had this kind of varied background. But I think for me, the teachings of the Buddha, what really sets them apart is this notion that they're not things for me to believe. So I don't have to believe. It's not, I believe that suffering is a part of life. It's that I discover for myself that when I cling, suffering arises. And just to look at my daily life, to look at when I try and hang on to something, that, you know, something pleasurable happens, and I try and hang on to it and grasp that suffering ensues, or if I try and push away and resist something that's arising in the moment that's unpleasant, that suffering arises. And just to really, really see that. So I can say that a million times, and you can, a thought may arise, well, that doesn't sound true, or maybe that does sound true, you know, depending on your lived experience. Either one could either thought could arise. But to really know it involves practicing with it in your life. And so this is what, it's a kind of a call to action. The Four Noble Truths from here is a call. Some people call them the ennobling truths, because there's this sense of action, an adjective rather than a noble truth. It's ennobling truth. Call to action so we could see our potential as human beings to alleviate suffering. So it's not, we believe that suffering is a part of life. We believe that the origin of suffering is tension. We believe that the cessation of suffering comes from the release of tension. And we believe the Eightfold Noble Path leads to cessation of suffering. The Buddha never said, these four things, and then if you would take these statements and believe them, that you can be a Buddhist. First of all, he never started anything called Buddhism, but also he never said, believe what I say. In fact, this is what he did say, and this is a shocking thing to a lot of religious people. He said, don't believe anything anybody says. Don't believe. The word believe is key there. It doesn't mean don't practice things that people offer you, but don't believe anything anybody says, including me. Look at your own experience and discover for yourself what is true. Don't believe anything anybody says, including me. Words from the Buddha. And what I found with my Christianity was many of the things were creeds. There were statements that couldn't be tested empirically from my experience. They could either be believed or not believed. And there are things within Buddhism too, a few items where I've had to go, okay, I can't test that. I cannot test rebirth empirically, unless I have visions of past lives that are convincing enough that I can say, okay, yeah, I really think I actually was a monk in my last life, or a poodle, or a worm, or whatever the case is. But yeah, so there are some of those, and there's people like Stephen Batchelor said, I can't be a monk any longer because I don't believe in rebirth, and that's part of being a monk, is, I guess, that you felt that you needed to have that belief. But that's the only one where I can kind of go, okay, I don't, it may be true, it may not be true, I don't know. Karma is different, because karma, you can say, every action, karma is just action, and every action has consequences. There's a ripple effect. So everything we do has this ripple effect out in the world, and then causes other ripple effects when they impact other people and other beings. So karma I can see, but that karma carries over into the next life. So when people ask, in fact, when people ask the Buddha that, he said, you know, don't fuss. There's 14 questions the Buddha never answered, and that was one of them. He said, don't fuss about that. I'm paraphrasing here, but don't fuss about that. Just do this practice. One thing he's very good at is giving practices to people to help them from where they were at. Very individualized practices. So the Eightfold Path, the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, is the path that he lays out. It says, here's the Eightfold, a set of principles that are that he is referred to as the Eightfold Path, also called the Middle Way, that avoids both indulgence and asceticism. And it's often depicted as a wheel, if you can see that. It's a wheel. It's a very small picture, but picture like I guess the wheel on a ship, or it's often the symbol, the wheel of the Dharma. And I think, as opposed to getting away from the idea that these are linear steps that one follows, but that they're all interlinked, and that you build them all simultaneously because they're so much interlinked. And it's really a way of living your life with an orientation towards freedom. My teacher Matthew Flickstein often says to what he's teaching most these days is how to live an authentic life, as he calls it. How to orient your living as if you were enlightened. So if you live your life as if you were enlightened, and not just question and say, well, one of these days I'll be enlightened and then everything will be fine, but you just, because you're already actually enlightened, you're already free, there's dust in our eyes, right? We don't see it. But if you can just live as if you were free, live with that orientation, things just fall into place. So it's not a list, in other words, of things to become a better person. It's not like a self-improvement list. And I've said this so much in this class, in this group. That it's not about self-improvement. Yeah.
I just was saying about the image. So it's like the steering wheel of the boat.
Yes.
To steer your that's the image. So this kind of thing is kind of a guide.
Uh huh.
That you can use to. That's what I understand what you're saying too. That you use this for. Living
with it as you go along. Mhm. Kind of the steering wheel.
Yes.
And so, and I like the boat analogy too, because no matter what, you can't control what the boat experience is, right? You can't control the weather. So it'd be like steering the boat and going, "Oh, that damn weather! It's not windy enough." I'd get all upset about it. The idea is you just kind of, okay, this is what I have to. Just to maneuver through, and it's okay. That notion of acceptance. Yeah, it's a neat image. Should have made a bigger one, but see, it does look like that steering wheel. And there's different versions of it. If you Google, you'll get like a whole page of. But they have that wheel orientation, spokes in a wheel. So the Buddha described the Eightfold Path as a path a means to enlightenment. So it's not like beginner instructions by any means. It's not a lesser vehicle. It's actually the one lesser vehicle, sometimes what Theravadins cause, called by Mahayana and Vajrayana Buddhists, which some see as a derogatory phrasing, and some people don't, but it's not a lesser vehicle, it's not a beginner instructions. It's in fact, it's having just mentioned sort of the three different major schools of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths is one of the teachings that all three schools see as the base, the basis of the Buddhist teachings. Yeah.
So historically, what would have, was enlightenment a term that, common people would relate to at that day, or was there another sense of what enlightenment would mean from a religious perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in those days, he was in India, northern India. In India, in those days, was to use a Western term, Hindu, or they were practicing Brahmanism, perhaps more accurately, based on the Vedas, the holy books called Vedas, and in that there is enlightenment, a path of enlightenment. The path was involved. The Brahman was seen as the portal to enlightenment. So to become a Brahman and then become enlightened after that. So it was.
But the concept of Brahman is pretty wide.
Well, though they were caste. So there were, you know, there were distinct separations between people in terms of their, and only Brahmins could do certain rituals, and it was a fairly strict, strictly laid out. I mean, the Buddha was a revolutionary. He was not in favor of the caste system. He was against slavery, which was very widespread in those days, all, you know, everywhere. To come out against slavery in those days was like speaking openly, I don't know, against capitalism in Northern America, and going into the heartland of Alabama and saying, capitalism is evil. I mean, this is kind of how sort of radical he was. And the other thing was he believed in equality between men and women, which was way out there for his time. I mean, sorry, we're still working on that one, right? 2,500 years later, a lot of people in the world, including Westerners, haven't got that one. So the fact that he believed that women could become enlightened was completely new. It was not existent in the Hindu tradition. So
was that concept of enlightenment?
So it was there. The concept was similar. The Buddha talked about it more in terms of how it affects how you live your life and relate to other people and the world now, as opposed to it being, you know, something. Becoming heavenly and a celestial being and a diva, and it's kind of, so it's much more grounded in the here and now. Like people would ask him, "Are you going to be reborn and come back?" And he wouldn't answer those questions. What happens to you after you die? Just concentrate on that. Don't worry about those kind of questions. He didn't kind of put it in those words, but he would always direct people back to the practical. Moment by moment experience, but the concept of enlightenment was definitely in the vocabulary, and nirvana was a term as well that was in the vocabulary. Yeah, to be awake. Yeah, that's a good question, because the context which within which these teachings were placed is so important, right? Because sometimes we read them and we go, wow, that sounds kind of weird, because well, for one, they were taught as an oral tradition, so there's a lot of repetition. It's kind of like memory maps, because people memorized them, chanted them, and then would. That's how it would get passed on and on. Plus, they used a lot of vocabulary. He taught in Pali, which is a language of the people. It was Sanskrit and Pali at the time. Sanskrit was more a language of the Brahmins and the upper castes, and Pali was the more common language. The Buddha taught in Pali, so there's the Pali canon. Then you got to translate from that into English, and people say it's difficult to translate. I'm not even sure we know what some of these words actually mean. You know, whether, you know, I think there's a lot of guesswork that when I talk to translators, well, where did that say? Well, first, do we know that it was even said that way? And so there's a lot of guesswork that went into putting these into English. For sure, but they people know enough about the history that you're asking about to be able to do that, and that word enlightenment is a critical one. Yeah.
Well, I just understood what you say. I don't know if I've heard that said Jim Armstrong, the great transformation. She offers a very interesting perspective into that period. It's very sensitive. Very insightful from what the common consciousness seems to be, what the discovery seems to be, which is that the most wrong compassion seems to be the common being, but it's understood differently depending on the historical context. But I did into it, so let's talk about Buddhism as well as the Greek philosophy. The Chinese masters, and the Jewish tradition. But it's very interesting to see how that concept of environment kind of arises from the local spirituality and how it evolves from the. So anyway, they found it very interesting, but for me, what really resonates with that notion that enlightenment is the way we understand enlightenment really is tied to the historical context. Mm-hmm. And even today, it's like you were talking about the book. It's true, the book cannot read our way to enlightenment, but in our day and time, that's how we have access to those teachings, right? For the most part, right? We live in a different historical context, and we don't have that direct access to teachers who could guide us in a more direct way, perhaps. For me, books are like teachers. They're a guide. They point you in a direction, but you do have to discover for yourself. And again, the way we live our lives, we are constrained. You're saying, live your life with your feet. But we are constrained in our ability to do that. It's because we do live in our this place and in this time, and it's like sometimes we can't just go and be whole completely free, because it would be like Buddha, who I really love the story when he meets the old yogi,
Yogi, yeah.
Yeah, the yogi. And, you know, you really have to know how to address.
Mm-hmm.
You live in a world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's, so, even today, I think enlightenment is, we have to find our way to enlightenment, considering the historical context in which we live.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Karen Armstrong, The Great Transformation. Yeah. Yeah. The context, and you know, the context of being in the West, in North America, and how Buddhism has come to North America as kind of one dharma is very interesting. It's a real melding of the different traditions that exist in Asia, because you have, you know, the Theravadan countries, Mahayana countries, Vajrayana countries, but it's coming to the West in this kind of melding way, and I think a very powerful way, having traveled a lot in Asia and seen how in a way things are stuck in many countries. They practice. And this may sound uninformed, or it may sound crass. We practice Buddhism the way we practice Christianity here, without, very superficially, for the most part. Not getting deeper. And I find that in the West we're taking the practices to heart more so than in many Eastern countries, where it's just making merit. You go and you give your money. You do your bowing and then you go home, kind of like going to church on Sunday, putting your money in the offering, and then go home and you forget about it the rest of the week. So I think it's very, the context is very interesting. And in terms of books and, well, the internet, you can Google, you know, Tibetan secret teachings and get the whole text of teachings that weren't offered to people by Tibetan masters until somebody had practiced for 25, 35, 45 years, right? Which can be a blessing, and it can be a disadvantage as well, as we can become trying to jump too far ahead. I think teachers are very important as well. There's a lot of teachers in the West to access, and teachers can, having a teacher is very important, because teachers can get to know your mind and get to know sort of what practice to parse out to help you get to the next, to overcome the obstacle perhaps that you're facing at that time, whatever that might be. And it's often different for different people. And at the pace that's appropriate, the level of understanding that's appropriate for the person. So I find books, you know, they just kind of put stuff in there and can be confusing, right? Because you're thinking this, and then somebody says this, and it can become intellectual, but it can also become, even the practices can become confusing. Like, so what do I do? You know, you read a book and I'm going to follow my breath at the tip of my nose, and then you pick up a book from somebody from a Mahasi, follow your belly. Oh, I guess I should follow the, just to give you a simple example, and this can go on to all kinds of different practices. So I think it's important to have a teacher. Maybe I'll do a session on finding a teacher and how to go about that and what that might look like for you. Yeah. And living as if you're free, I mean, it doesn't mean that we become homeless, wanderers. It could mean that, but in our context, it generally means, we're not monks or nuns for the most part. We're householders, to use the Buddhist phrase. Phrasing, we have a job and often a family, and and all the, and, you know, things, responsibilities. So it's bringing, it's living as if you are free within that context. That's so crucial. But that doesn't mean it can't be done. There's another whole series of talks on that, and it's really what my teacher now is concentrating on, is offering teachings on living. He calls it living living authentically. And by authentic, he means that you're already free. Our true nature, our inherent nature, is Buddha-ness. So he's basically saying you're living as if you are a Buddha. You are. Your true nature is, your inherent nature is Buddha-ness. So it's, but we don't see it because of our conditioning. So it's to, if we live that way, that conditioning can start to fall away. Say, oh, I don't have to react this way, or that's just the story I've been telling myself. If I live this authentic way, you start to see through the clouds, the obstructions, can start to fall away. It's a path. Some might say it's a more direct path, because the other path is to, you know, really work with purifying the mind and work with our conditioning. And seeing through them, sort of gradually and step by step. The other way is to say, okay, yeah, I've seen enough. I've had enough glimpses of the way things are that I really know it. So that's the stage where you can start to live as if you're free. If you just kind of go, I'm new to this, and I'm just going to... I think you need that view. You need that kind of view to keep you there. So that's,
it's kind of a general question. So how do you guard against your practice becoming habitually conditioned? You understand what I'm saying? So that you come to a certain type of meditation, or style of meditation, that you become accustomed to, that you can create to see the cause and effect of conditioning. And keeping it fresh rather than changing it. Or is it like a lab, you know, where you're continuing to try to become practice, at least till it speaks to you?
Mm-hmm. So do you find you're doing the same, you've been doing the same practice for...
I mean, sometimes. There's just patterns of time that, well, feel it.
So what's your primary practice right now? Is it concentration practice following the...
You know, I do a bit of... I'll start with that. I mean, I used to just do that. And I can do that. But then I like the concept of natural meditation. But I find it still a little confusing to what that actually means. I kind of get the concept a little bit. So sometimes it's just, you know, wait for a second.
You kind of answered your own question there by saying wait and see. I think we can have expectations that things are going to happen a particular way and at a that perhaps a faster pace. Often that's what we desire. And so as you said, just kind of sit and wait is really what is good advice that you gave it just at the end there. I like the way people do that. They'll ask the question, and then if you let them talk long enough, they give you the answer just before they're finished. So striving can become an issue in people's practice. And that doesn't mean we don't have goals. I mean, we have goals, but there's a way to just have the, you know, to set the intention, I think, might be the word that we often use in Buddhism is, you know, set an intention to practice and then just sit. Whatever the just sitting might look like. And sitting is simple. I mean, you say it's, you know, it can look habitual, but it's you know, there's only, it's not that complicated as a technique, as a technology. I mean, it's way simpler than your laptop. It's really, as a technology, it's simple. The power of it comes from the repetition and the sustaining it. I call sustaining it and integrating it. So sustaining it throughout your day. So we don't just sit to become good meditators. And we don't, and the meditating part of it is, you know, it's like the rehearsal. But the real performance is you're walking out into the world. And that's where you're, this awareness and this observation, investigation, for me personally, that's where it really, that's where the learning really happens. The understanding really happens is when that gets taken into the world. So I get to know, wow, this mind, this is how this mind responds and or reacts in these situations. Interesting, without judging it. So it's kind of that bare awareness, just oh, wow, amazing, wow, as opposed to, ooh, that's not nice, I shouldn't react that way, how can I fix that? But just getting to know. And then, just letting it arise and then coming back to what's happening in this moment now. So training the mind to come back to the present moment when you notice that it's whirling away on something else. So that's so again, it's a simple technology, but the challenge is, in my practice historically, has been remembering to then live that in the world. That, you know. Yeah, and the more we practice, the more often we remember, because it becomes a habit. It becomes a new habit. Our habitual habit. Can you say that? The way we habitually live is, you know, stimulus reaction, like, dislike. Yeah, and just noticing how that shifts how you are. I'm amazed. Like I'm still amazed, even though I don't know how many gazillion times I've experienced it. But I'm still amazed how, if I'm in a reactive mode, and I'm not noticing. Right? So what's happening is there's a constriction in my stomach and a tightening in my head. And my eyes actually get a little bloodshot and I get tense. And then to notice how when I step out of that, I notice it and go, oh, this is what's happening. I can notice that and let it go and then see the shift to a much more easeful way. It's amazing.
Yeah. It leads to, it's like a perfect segue or whatever, to the practice of knowing ourselves and knowing us and reflecting on our thoughts or watching our thoughts. But I think we have a need, human beings have a need for awakening or spiritual need, and I think we're neurologically we're need to be in relationship, so that change in my life, change comes through interacting with other people and practicing that scary part of being, working at being kind of my authentic self in relationship with other people. And that wonder where that is more important than in this world, in this modern world where we're all kind of superficially connected, but we're not authentically connected very much. Community seems really important for us. That's why I belong to a church, because there's, I have history with people, and there's a core there that that we can practice with each other. And that I'm wondering about how this practice, how you practice and support each other in this practice. Going out in the world, or you feel like you're going out in the world alone with just yourself, learning to interact. And in Buddhist words or his teachings, where is the practice with your fellow human beings coming to you? Oh, where's the guidance? How can I be guided in that? Not just in your chosen community, but out into the world. So the balance of your chosen community and out into the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a struggle for me.
Okay. So, There's two ways to look at this. There's the notion of your spiritual community, and then the notion of the larger community of people. In terms of the spiritual community, I'll talk about that first. The spiritual community, the Buddha talked about the three jewels, or the three refuge. In fact, many people start their meditation by paying homage to the three refuge, and that's the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha being your Buddha nature, so the Buddha within you. So when somebody goes like this, they're bowing to the divinity in you. And when we bow to the Buddha, we're bowing to the divinity in all of us. So that's the first one. The second one, the Dharma, is the teachings. And the third is Sangha, which translates to community. And so the idea is those are the three jewels of Buddhism that and one of them being the community, having the support of it's really an emphasis on the support of a spiritual community. And that's why we have Sangha. You know, we call this the Wednesday night sitting group, but I often refer to it as the Sangha. But because it's a Buddhist word, and we're not all Buddhists, I call it the Wednesday night sitting group. So it's very, very central to the Buddhist teachings. Very, very front and center. In terms of the wider community, the teachings, it varies between tradition. In Theravada Buddhism, you've got the whole notion of non-harming, wise speech, wise action, and that all is how we bring ourselves out into the world. And in fact, really, when you look at, when I say investigate what's arising within, because it is inward looking, it is mostly about what's arising when we're interacting with other people. Very little arises when you're just alone. I mean, stop. But most, a lot of our triggers and our buttons, juicy stuff happens when we're in social settings. So the practice is really, I think, comes alive in the social settings. And, you know, many teachings on just how to behave, in community, in the wider community. The Mahayanas go as far to say, you know, they have bodhisattva vows, which are just all about service. And closer, perhaps, to the Christian notion of service. In fact, I will not be, here's a vow. I just took the bodhisattva vow with Lama Suridas. It's a vow not to become, enlightened until all beings can become enlightened. So the idea is your service, it's all about service. Enlightenment, the path to enlightenment is service to others. So that's another way to look at, you know, an emphasis within Buddhism. But at the same time, there's an inner exploration. So we can't care for others until we can care for ourselves. So there's a self-love that comes, that is cultivated, allows us to be in love with everyone.
The analogy I always tell people is when those oxygen masks come down in the airplane.
Yeah.
You put it on yourself first, then you can help the person behind you.
Yeah.
So you can't give from a deficit of your deficit yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
I was looking around that as far as I was wondering, Buddhism is much more non-self. Even for all the education, we reach that level where we realize that we're not better. And I think that's one of the main ideas in the Kamanchari book, that we're not better than for myself, one thing about what you were saying about the habituation of the practice, I do find it challenging to maintain that beginner's mind. And I think it's also because sometimes you do have good experiences and you expect them to be repeatable. Sometimes they're not, because we do, like our states change, right? So, and we might become a little bit disillusioned and kind of lose a bit of, yeah. But one practice that for me fails less often is the metta kind of practice, where you wish your family and all beings, you wish them well. And I find that I can reach very consistent results when I do that. And it really does go to the core of the concept of not separate, in it together. Even when we're sitting by ourselves, we can reflect on that. But I'm so happy to make all these people and think of them. It is one of the core materials.
It's interesting that all spiritual traditions have the same ultimate truth. And as you were saying, that we are not separate. That we're, it sounds New Agey to say we are one, but I mean that we actually, the sense of a separate, independent self is an illusion. And so that, I think, is the ultimate, as you were saying, it's the ultimate sense of community. But we can talk about that at so many different levels, the relative and the ultimate. The ultimate level. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I've always really liked that about Buddhism and a lot of Eastern philosophies about how they talk about how the individual self is an illusion and how everything is pretty much the same experience, the same phenomenon. Because, I mean, you think about, like, just, like, subatomic and quantum physics, it's, like, proven that at a certain level of physical reality, everything's basically the same substance, more or less. So I guess, in a sense, that's true in many ways. And it's always kind of helped me get through the day, really, to think about how it's just one continual experience. There's not really any kind of separation between anyone. I don't know.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, the dialogue's going on between quantum physics and Buddhism in particular is very fascinating. If you're interested, there are more books, but I don't think you two should read any more. But the quantum and the have you read the Quantum and the Monk? I think it's called the Quantum and the Monk.
I have not.
Yeah. Yeah. There's it's a dialogue between a quantum physicist and a Buddhist monk, and they're just constantly agreeing, right?
Yeah.
And they're speaking at, you know, scientific and a very spiritual level, and they're both going, yeah, that makes sense, and you're just kind of seeing them have this very deep dialogue and
it's
making
interesting
sense.
How like some of these ancient traditions like Buddhism and Taoism, it's almost like they, and same with Western philosophy too, like, you know, a lot of ancient theories of knowledge, it's like they touched upon some scientific truths that are revalidated by cutting-edge physics. And it's just amazing how there's some immutable, eternal truth that had been noticed in, like, totally different epochs of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is kind of amazing, yeah. Oh, mysterious and amazing.
Yeah.
As a physicist, I would caution that the physics physical world, and I don't think it answers all
the questions. No, we haven't proven Buddhism with quantum physics. You know, it's all very, I find it all very entertaining for the mind. This is what this mind reaches for when it's a little bored, books like that, you know, that show. Then I have to remember, okay, I am entertaining this mind, and I'll get back to, you know, reality, you know, which is just being in the present moment and not in book land. But you know, this group does attract to a degree a bit of a booky crowd, I find. So I would
isn't everyone in Ottawa kind of bookish?
I would yeah. I've been to other sangha. Yeah. But I would invite you to put more emphasis, and I'm being very direct here, but it's what teachers are supposed to do, is put more emphasis on the practice rather than the reading of books. And look at reading of books as you entertaining your mind. For the most part. I mean, you'll get tidbits, but you get enough knowledge from what you hear here to get you through the week. You get enough practice. I mean, you could, you know, pick a book like, I don't know, what's a good, I like Philip Moffat's book on the Four Noble Truths, Dancing with Life, I think it's called, or Being the Dharma by Jack. Just pick up one of those books and just go through it a chapter for like a month. And just, you know, if there's a practice in it, do that practice for a month. That's practicing. That's using books to practice the Dharma. The way I used to read books is, you know, I'd have four or five of them going, and that's me entertaining my mind. Which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But just realize that that's what you're doing. That it's not really advancing your knowing of your mind, or your training of your mind, or your freeing of the mind. It's entertaining the mind. Yeah. Just realize that. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's just like watching TV. I like to watch TV. I have Netflix. I'm entertaining my mind. I may watch, you know, there's a great one, I Am That. Great document. But I'm entertaining my mind. I might get a few tidbits of knowledge that I can throw out.